Okay, so in this lecture we're going to talk about processing the data. So you go out into the field, you take your gravity readings, and then you do quite a lot of calculations, correcting for the free air effect, the Bugue effect, the latitude correction, terrain, and so on and so forth. And at the end of the day, you've got a bunch of numbers. But obviously, the geological structure that you're looking for is not going to jump out of that list of numbers. You've got to do a bit of work in order to tease out the geology and get the most acceptable answer. You have to process the data and you have to interpret it, and I'm going to give you a couple of examples of how that's done. This will more or less cover gravity, and next week we're going to concentrate on a case history. So these five lectures will have given you, you know, a block on gravity. And everybody should spend some of their 200 slat hours that you're supposed to spend on this this module doing a bit of reading around about gravity. Find yourself a nice case history of an area that you're interested in. Maybe you're interested in volcanoes, maybe you're interested in oil reservoirs, whatever. You know, read around, find something up, take some notes to augment what's been taught in lecture. And then if you answer a question in the exam on gravity surveying, you'll have some information there that you can give an example, and that will be evidence for having read around the subject. First class marks are not given unless students show evidence in their exam answers that they've done some external independent reading. So if I mark your exam question, I'm going to say, yes, that's right, that's answered correctly, blah, 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 that's all absolutely correct. But if I see nothing except what I taught in the lecture, your mark essentially will be capped at 7 out of 10, 70% for that question. In order to try to get those extra 30 marks, you have to show independent reading. So these five gravity lectures, the four up to now and next week's, that's a good block of work to do a block of reading around. Okay, data processing. The first thing you have to worry about is the regional trend. So as soon as you've got your results plotted up, it might be a profile, it might be a map, the first thing you think of is there a regional trend that I have to remove? The deeper the body, the broader the anomaly. So I hope you found that out when you did this question two on the example sheet. There was a little bit there about what the shape of the point mass looked like if its depth was doubled. It would be broader and it would be lower in amplitude. And you may have an anomaly like that superimposed on shallower anomalies. And you may want to try to remove the effect of the deeper body. You may not be interested in that. It may just be basement slope or something like that you're not interested in. Or you may be interested in that and you might want to get rid of the shallow anomalies. Come on, talk to me. Sorry about this. Okay, back in business. So we might be interested in the deeper body. We might be interested in what we normally call the regional. That might give you sedimentary basin thickness, for example, or we might be interested in the shallower bodies. So this slide shows you an example of a situation like this. So here we've got a slope on the basement. And here we have a shallow ore body. And the gravity field that you would measure in a transect along here would add, obviously, you must, I'm sure, all readily know, the effect of the basement slope and the ore body. So we'd get something like this, which is basically the sum of this regional trend plus this effect due to the shallow body. So there are different ways of removing the regional trend, and then you can either interpret this or interpret that according to what you're interested in. And this is rather a cute little YouTube video, which tells you something about regional trends and local trends, except in the context of climate science. So, let's see if it'll roll for us.
A common mistake when interpreting statistics is to look at them from too short a distance. This can make everything unclear and confusing. So forget the details and take a step back. You're looking at a dog when you should be concentrating on the owner. As you can see, the dog is all over the place, leaping and bouncing, sometimes upwards, sometimes downwards. But where do you think it will be in 10 seconds' time? Around here, right? But at this moment, the dog is on its way downward. So why do you think it will find itself up there? It's because you noticed the owner. The owner is the trend, and it's he who determines where they both will be in a while, as a bit longer than a couple of dog pounds. He could change direction. There's a lot we don't know about this guy, but everything we do know indicates he's heading in that direction. The owner is the long-term trend. The dog is the variation around this trend. Or the owner is the climate, the dog is the weather.
How about that then? I think that's pretty cute. Okay. Does that say PowerPoint? Right. So, the owner in our case is the slope on the basement, and the dog is the shallow all bodies. So, there are a number of ways in which you can remove the regional trend, and you know, if you're going to do gravity for your dissertation, you might want to get a bit more sophisticated than just eyeballing it. But eyeballing it is, tends to be what is done. Somebody drew up a very nice graph. I think I may have mentioned it yesterday on the question on the Galena body that you're doing in the practicals. And if you draw up a graph carefully, to get the regional trend on that map there, you do actually see two trends. The trend has got a slope in one part of the region and a slightly different slope in the other part of the region. And that was rather nice. I hadn't actually seen anybody pull that out so nicely before. So you can take something like this and you can say, well, there's a large bowl here. This is a distance of 200 kilometres. I'm not interested in this large bowl. This is a big sedimentary basin or something like this. I'm interested in these smaller features here, in which case you might eyeball a bowl shaped anomaly like this, or two V's or something like this, could even be two linear slopes, and then you would end up with something like that left over. You could do it digitally, and one of my project students has decided that she's going to get quite sophisticated in her project, and she's going to do it on a computer digitally. And this is called Griffin's method. So this is the point in question, and Griffin's method involves measuring from the gravity map the value of gravity at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 points in a circle around the point. You average those 8 points and you subtract it from the value of gravity at your point. Then you move on to the next point and you take the value of gravity at 8 points and do the same thing there. So that's a somewhat more rigorous and numerically based method of removing the regional. And people have kind of taken this even further and suggested even more complex ways of doing it. So here we have a scheme where the observation point is again here. There's a circle with 4 points, and then there's a larger diameter circle with another 4 points, and then a third circle here. And again, you're averaging gravity and subtracting it. You can use trend surface analysis. You could read it into a computer and fit a low or even a higher order polynomial to your trend and subtract that. Obviously, you know, this is subjective. How many terms of this polynomial are you going to take? Are you going to go up to the terms in x and y squared? So, you know, you could go on forever until you remove everything and you've got nothing left over. So this is the problem with removing regionals. It's really a question of judgment. And if you go too crazy, you're going to remove some of the signal that you're interested in. But if you don't go far enough, then you may corrupt your answers. You can use spectral analysis. You can take a spectrum of your gravity field, and then you can just throw out either the long wavelengths, which correspond to broad scale bodies, or you can throw out the short wavelengths corresponding to the small scale bodies. So here's an example of a Bugo anomaly map, and there's some kind of channel here, which may be a valley, something like that, sediment-filled valley. And this is the low frequencies thrown out, so we're just looking at the very broadest picture. And here we're looking at, here we've thrown out the broad scale anomalies, and we're just looking at the small anomalies. And it's quite typical when analysing gravity map like this to try a range of different things. Because, you know, the reason you're doing a gravity study is because you don't know as much as you want to about the area. So, you know, you don't necessarily know what you're looking for. And once the data are in the computer, you can do all sorts of things and try removing different kinds of regionals to see if something interesting pops up. So it's not always totally objective. Here we see a global example of long wavelength features, very, very broad features, and short scale ones. So I think I've shown you this satellite gravity map in the past. And we can see relatively small scale features, and people are even producing, you know, very recently there was an even more detailed version of the global gravity map produced, and you can see features that are just a few kilometres across. People have now discovered that there are huge numbers of seamounts all throughout the oceans that we didn't know about before. Seamounts are submarine volcanoes. We used to think that there were just a few chains and maybe quite a few seamounts over here, but in the rest of the ocean is largely devoid of seamounts, or they come in linear chains. But people are now finding that the whole seafloor is just simply covered with seamounts. And Lara Kalmins, who's a lecturer in the department here, she gave a talk on her work yesterday, which I couldn't go to because I've got a class. But she's studying seamounts, and she's using intelligent computer-based methods to try to find seamounts from the bathymetric data that we have. So, of course, looking at gravity is another way of doing that. But having said that, this is the same data, except it's been processed to get rid of all the short wavelength features. It's got rid of all the seamounts, it's got rid of all the features associated with trenches and things like this, and we're just looking at the very broadest features that have a wavelength, you know, which is comparable to the circumference of the Earth. So this is the gravity high in the North Atlantic. And here we have the Charlie Gibbs fracture zone, the Azores triple junction, and the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And here we have the gravity low, which is just to the south of India. So this gravity low here is this one. And this gravity high here is essentially the whole of the North Atlantic. Okay, moving on to data processing, the depth effect. This is something that needs to be borne in mind at all times. Here we have a shallow body, and here it's placed at a larger depth, and here it's deeper still, and you can see the effect on the gravity field. So where it's very shallow, the gravity anomaly is quite narrow, and it's very large in amplitude. The greater the depth, the broader the anomaly. So let me see now. The horizontal scale is the same in all these plots, but the vertical scale is different. So this vertical scale goes from 1 to minus 0.175. This goes from 0 to minus 0.175. This goes from 0 to minus 0.004. So this vertical scale here would correspond to about this much in the top plot. So the deeper you go, the more attenuated the gravity signal becomes and the broader the anomaly. everybody should look back at question two and make sure that they did that part of the question there. You could look at the vertical derivative. Sometimes you can look at the actual gravity field, and that doesn't necessarily tell you everything that the data contains, which is a little bit counterintuitive. But here we have a gravity anomaly from the Texas Gulf Coast, and you can see there's a kind of heart-shaped anomaly here. If you just looked at this anomaly and you did nothing else with it, you might say, well, there's a some sort of heart-shaped body centered round about here. But in fact, mining of this area has shown that the bodies of interest are these things shown in red. And just looking at the gravity map, you would not necessarily have found those bodies. However, if you look at the second derivative, you've calculated the gradient of the gradient of this gravity field, you find that you get a number of isolated highs here, which correspond quite well to the position of these bodies. Not perfect, but it's a whole lot better. It's quite a spectacular example of removing the regional. So this is a cement field in Oklahoma, and if you just look at the raw gravity map, which is this thing here, you wouldn't think there was anything there at all. But the regional has been very carefully removed, and an anomaly, as shown in this lower graph, pops up. And this is an almost perfect correlation with the cement field. So removing the regional extremely carefully can, you know, you can only model what you can see on the map in front of you. And these methods are things which need to be applied to the data, so that you can look at the data in many different ways and get some idea of what might pay to model. Just a few other methods mentioned in passing. You can calculate isostatic anomalies if you're looking at isostatic problems. You can calculate the vertical derivative of gravity and the horizontal gradient of gravity. You can use a method called upward and downward continuation, which means that you calculate what the gravity field would look like if you measured it at a higher or a lower level. So upward continuation would be taking your gravity field and calculating what it would look like if you measured it, say, 1 kilometer higher up. You can imagine that this would have the effect of attenuating the body, so instead of seeing a lot of noise, you know, that would be greatly attenuated. You'd just see more of a broader picture. And downward continuation is calculating what the gravity field would look like if you'd measured it at a lower depth. And also presentation. We have plotting tools nowadays so that you can show any gravity field or anything like that in a sort of topographic sense, sideways illuminated, and presented as though it's topographic. And the presentation makes a huge difference to what you see in the data. A picture says 1,000 words, and it's often possible to make something really important pop out of the page with a well-designed figure, whereas it would have been overlooked if you hadn't taken such a lot of care. Yes. You're removing gravity signal and you're left with gravity signal.
Is there different types of data that you're removing compared to what you're left with?
No, it's all, you know, you'll have a, just as you were doing in question six, you'll have a map which is covered with dots, and these are all the values of gravity. And you're just removing part of that gravity. You're saying some of that signal is due to a regional effect and some of it's due to the local effect I'm interested in. Speeches are like data, you know, you can kind of put it in a different way and it has much more understandable. Anyway, talk to me again in the practical if you want further explanation. So, you've processed your data. You went out in the field, you measured your data, you plot it up on maps, and then you spent a long time worrying about the regional. Are you interested in the deep thing, or you've tried looking at second derivatives, you've compared it to the geology, you've assembled as much backup information, independent backup information as and then you move on to interpretation. Now, your boss is not wanting a long speech about how you cleverly removed the regional. Your boss is wanting a geological interpretation. That's this very last thing that you do. So there are two ways in which you could go about it. One is known as the indirect or inverse approach. And this is a method where you use the data to draw conclusions about the causative body. So this is what you have been doing in the practicals. You've been given gravity data and you've been using those gravity data to try to double guess what the body is that's causing the signal. But another way you can do it, and we don't do it so much in this class because it needs computer, and maybe one day we can get some sort of modelling tool that you can all load on your laptops. But what you do is to erect a geological model in the computer, and the computer will then calculate what the gravity signal of that body should be. You compare that to the data and see what your misfit is, and then you can continue adjusting it until you get a fit. So there are these two fundamentally different ways of going about it. When you do your interpretation, you have to always be mindful of the ambiguity problem. So if you're writing an essay or answering an exam question about data interpretation, you always want to make sure that you very prominently mention this issue. And that is that given some data, given some gravity data, there are an infinite number of theoretical ways in which you could explain it. This just simply illustrates this. Here we have four identical gravity anomalies. These are all exactly the same. They could be produced by a point mass or a sphere under the ground. And here we have four different pairs of dimensions and density. So here we've got a 5 meter radius sphere and a density of 0.25. We've got a 5.39 metre sphere and a density of 0.2, and so on and so forth. So there could be an infinite number of different spheres. So this obviously is a problem because if you're doing this as a project, your boss is going to want to know what is the depth to this anomaly and how big is it, how much resource there is there. But the gravity can only tell you the mass excess or deficiency. It can't tell you the actual dimension. Of course, what you can do is to calculate the mass excess or deficiency and then look independently for the real densities of the materials in question, and then you can, from the mass deficit or excess, you can calculate the amount of resource. But you have to bungee in some independent information. So, there are quite a number of ways of inverse interpretation, where you take the data and you deduce something about the body. We've used several of these in the practicals. So one is to look at the half width of the body. So here we have some kind of anomaly here. This is a good old American unit of the mile. So this body is maybe 4 kilometres across, so it's half width. Might be a kilometre, something like that, and the depth, the maximum depth to the top is of the order of the half width, the width of the anomaly where it drops to half its value. So you could tell just by looking at this graph here that the maximum depth to the top of the body is of the order of a kilometre. The body could be much shallower. There could be some material that's distributed in the near surface forming this. So we can't say what the minimum depth is, but we can say what the maximum depth is. Of course, that's quite lucky, because the boss is going to want to know what the worst case scenario is. What is the maximum depth? So here we have a much broader anomaly. This is the western United States, and here we have California and Nevada, Utah. And there's an enormous gravity high over this part of America, and this distance is about 1,000 kilometres. So the half width of this is going to be, say, 250, 300 kilometres, something. Gauss's theorem. So you're working on the question on the problem sheet that uses Gauss's theorem. Gauss's theorem states that the gravity flux from a body is equal to twice the Bugue equation. So you can imagine if you have a body and you have gravity flux coming from that body in three dimensions, what we observe on the surface is just the top half, if you like. We're just going to see half the gravity flux. So what we measure on the surface on a map is going to be half of the total amount. That's why it's a 2 pi gm and not 4. So this is what you're doing. You grid off the area. Of course, normally, you know, if you were doing this in a professional situation, you'd use a computer. You grid off the area. Remove the regional if there is one. You calculate the value of the gravity anomaly in each box, and if you've made all the boxes the same size, you can just add up the gravity anomalies and multiply once by the area. Of course, if the boxes were different sizes, you'd have to take gravity times the area of this box plus gravity times the area of this box plus gravity times the area of this box and so on. But if you make the boxes all the same size, you just have to do one multiple. This is quite a interesting way of trying to deduce what's going on downstairs, and this was invented by Professor Bott, who shares my office upstairs, and this is known as the second derivative method. We'll be dealing with this in greater detail next term when we do a more significant gravity problem, which is also in your problem sheets. So it can tell you about the nature of the upper corners of the body, and the nature of the upper corners of the body is quite important because if you don't get that right, you could get completely the wrong geology. So here we have a slab here, which is truncated at the end, and here we have the gravity field. Across it. So here we have one that's cut off at an angle, and we have a rather similar gravity field over it, and this one is cut off at a different angle, it's sloping the other way. And then again, you have this low gravity here and high gravity here. So the question is, how can you tell whether you have this situation, this, or this? And why do you care anyway? Well, the reason you care is because this is the shape of an igneous body. Igneous intrusions tend to be shaped like this, but sedimentary basins tend to have edges like this. Now, you know, it's quite important to know whether you've got a buried sedimentary basin or igneous intrusion, because a sedimentary basin could be hydrocarbon bearing. However, a granite intrusion is not likely to be hydrocarbon bearing, so it's the intrusion that's the basin. So if you find an anomaly somewhere, and says, oh, it's very interesting, you've got a low anomaly there, might this be a hydrocarbon-bearing sedimentary basin? You know, the boss is not going to be very pleased with you if you say, well, yes, I think it is, and a drilling rig is sent in there to drill, and it's found to be a granite intrusion. You'd probably be fired, especially if it's discovered that you could have told which it was to begin with by using the second derivative method discovered by Professor Bott about 40 years ago. So, obviously there's going to be a gravity anomaly associated with this corner here, and a gravity anomaly associated with this corner here. And the same goes for this. And you all know now that if a body is shallow, it's going to give you a strong, sharp, it's going to give you a narrow anomaly, quite strong. And if it's deep, it's going to be a broader anomaly and less strong. So if we trace gravity coming along over this, okay, it reaches this corner here, and this is quite shallow, so it's going to change very rapidly and very quickly. But because this corner is deeper, it's going to change much more gently. And the opposite is going to happen here. When you're on the outer corner here, there's going to be quite a gentle change. But when you come over this corner here, there's going to be a very sharp change. I think you can see this just looking at these lines. Here we've got a very sharp corner, and here we've got a gentle corner, and the opposite goes to this. So it is possible. also possible to calculate the second derivative. You take the gradient of this, and then you take the gradient of that, and we'll be doing an exercise to do that next term. And this is what you find. Here we have a granite intrusion, and this is the second derivative. So the second derivative is when you're on the outside of the body, you have quite a low amplitude anomaly here in the second derivative, which corresponds to this corner here. But over this corner here, which is much shallower, you have a much higher amplitude body. And you get the opposite effect here. Here we have the sedimentary basin, we have a very large amplitude anomaly corresponding to this corner, and just a very small amplitude anomaly corresponding to this corner. So using this method, you can tell if the sides slope in or out. Professor Bott applied this to the north of England, where we have quite a classic situation here, where if you go from east to west across Britain, you find this structure of alternating igneous intrusions. Here we have the Weardale granite, the Wensleydale granite, and there are sedimentary basins in between, pulp bounded. So this is quite interesting, even though it looks totally flat, you know, on the surface. So there's an interesting structure underneath. So Professor Bott quite famously did a gravity survey up in the Dales here, and he interpreted this as a granite intrusion under Northern Weardale. And the department managed to scrape together some money to drill a borehole, which is known as the Rookhope borehole. Has anybody told you about the Rookhope borehole? Yeah. Have they? You did it at school, did you? Have you been taught about the Rookhope borehole in the department?
No.
Okay, that's because all these ancient guys are now retired, and the staff is much. The current staff are post Rookhope, so it's not talked about so much. But anyway, this is in the days when he was just really pioneering gravity surveying. It was a new method, and he predicted that there was a granite there. And we had a another staff member who has now passed away, Sir Kingsley Dunham, and he was given a knighthood for finding a lot of mineral resources here in the north of England, which contributed to the war effort in World War II. So here was Sir Kingsley, who knew all about the mineralisation of the north, and this young whippersnapper, Martin Bott, who's now about 85 years old, comes along and he says, well, there's a buried granite intrusion here. So people put two and two together and made five, and said, well, maybe that's where the mineralisation comes from, because there was a granite intrusion in the area, and that brought a lot of heat in and caused the mineralisation. So they got money together to drill into this body to see if it was indeed a granite intrusion. And they found that this was correct. However, they found that the top of the granite had got a weathered top. And this meant that it was much, much, much older than the mineralisation. So it was one of those funny situations where everything seemed to fit together, but when you investigated it, you found that, you know, yes, your prediction was right, but not for the reason that you thought. You know, there are other funny stories, but we don't have time for them today. Okay, so as you've been experiencing in the practicals, there are various formulae that you can use very simplistically to give you a ballpark idea of what's going on. The slab formula is one. You can rearrange that to have an equation for the thickness of a body. So whatever body you've got, you know, the slab formula assumes that you've got an infinite slab. And of course, if you've got some kind of bullseye anomaly or something like this, that's not going to be a very good approximation. But it's still going to give you a rough idea of whether you've got something that's a kilometre thick, 100 metres thick, or 10 kilometres thick. So, you know, you can do this on the back of an envelope and immediately, you know what kind of scale of body you're dealing with. But then there's this other method here. So, okay, what you do when you interpret gravity is to take these indirect. Did somebody wake that sleeping student up? Are you not sleeping?
No.
Okay. you've done as much as you can applying the slab formula, the point mass formula, and measuring the half width of the body and this and that and the other, you make the best possible guess for the geological structure that you've had, and then you go to a computer and you erect a model based on what you've done. Okay, so we're back to forward interpretation here. This is the formula for a buried sphere. This could, the formula for a horizontal cylinder, maybe a good approximation for something such as a buried channel or a valley. This is the formula for a horizontal cylinder. This is the formula for a horizontal sheet. This is the formula for an infinite sheet. And here we have the slab formula, which is an infinite sheet of finite thickness. So in addition to the simple point mass formula, which we've used already, there are other formulae available if you want to do something a little bit more complex. And this is the formula for a cylinder, which you'll be using in the practical either this week or next week. And this is what you do in the computer once you've got as close as possible as you can to the actual geology. You'll enter into a computer the coordinates of the structure, and you'll enter into the computer the density contrast, these various things. And you'll type into the computer also your data. So your data may be these black points here. And the computer will calculate what the gravity effect of this geological structure is, and it will typically superimpose the theoretical line on your data, and you can look to see how well your data fit. Usually you find your data don't fit perfectly, so you have to adjust this to make it fit. But you have to bear in mind that you could either adjust the density, or you could adjust this, or adjust that, or adjust the other, and you could still get the perfect fit. It's very easy to get the perfect fit. So just adjusting the model in an arbitrary way, just in order to fit your data, is just going to give you one possible answer out of a huge number of candidates. So that's not the way to go. The way to go is to limit yourself to a model which is based on knowledge, and even if it doesn't fit perfectly, you typically just leave it like that and say, well, there's no information to say how this point should be fitted, yes, but not with something that's got anything to back it up. And this goes to show that different models can fit the data just as well, so the key thing is to get as much background data as possible. There are various different flavours of this computer modelling available. There's a two-dimensional sort where all of these units are considered to be infinite in and out of the screen. This is two-dimensional modelling, because that's not usually the case. 2.5 so-called dimensional modelling is where you define how far in and out of the sheet the body comes. And 2.75 is where it goes further out than it does into the forward, so to speak. But of course, three-dimensional modelling is the ultimate, if you like. Computer programs that do this are few and far between. We don't have one in the department, although we're starting to look at one, but usually this is not used. It seems to me that there shouldn't be such a terrible barrier to it, but it's just not something that has become very popular yet. So, let's finish up there, and at 10 o'clock I'll brief you on the practical work. Thank you.